think we'll get going. Bang the thing. And this is, I'm going to talk today under the umbrella this week of globalization, here, there, and yon. And I'm Kit Nagel. I'm on the faculty at Concordia College, 15 miles north of New York. And by the way, about half an hour, the bell's going to ring, and staff are supposed to go to a staff meeting. So if there's a mass exodus, it's not because of me. So this week, we're the third day of the talk, and Monday we talked about China, sort of on a macro basis, a new trade theory, and so a view of the world from, 30,000 feet. Then yesterday we talked about Saudi Arabia, sort of looking at a country basis on globalization and how Saudi Arabia is just a microcosm of globalization, where you have facilities that will have literally dozens of nationalities at a single facility. Not dozens of foreigners, dozens of nationalities. Remarkable place. And today we're going to talk about Tropicana in Tokyo. So this is much more, I'll call it a case study of doing business with specific product, specific market in a specific country. And doing business in Japan is very different from here. It's very difficult. It's often very hard just to get market access. And there is a deep cultural issues you need to address, and the Japanese are very xenophobic. Big $3 word. Xenophobia is the fear, right? Phobia of that which is different, that which is unknown, that which is foreign. And so Japan is a very homogeneous culture, so we'll say homogeneous, very protective of its cultural heritage. So much so that women who come to the West, educated in the West or work in the West, and then go back to Japan, have very high level of difficulty getting married because they have become tainted with Western culture. Okay, we are gaijin, we are foreign, we are barbarian. Okay, you guys are all gaijin. As another word, we're going to teach beyond gaijin, you probably heard that one, but if someone is rude, boorish, culturally insensitive, they are meiwaku. Can everybody say meiwaku?
Meiwaku.
Okay, meiwaku. And so, except for the taxi drivers and stuff, you do not tip in Japan. Okay. We've corrupted the taxi drivers, some people in hotels, but in the swath of society, you do not tip. And the reason is that they take honor from their work, and it is an honor for them to serve others, it is an honor for them to serve you, and you are insulting them by saying the only reason that they are holding the door or giving you good service is because you're going to give them a tip. And so Westerners that go to China are often, without knowing it, meiwaku. And it's so you see, the Japanese kind of looking at you sideways. So why are you insulting them? So let's get back to accessing a market that is a fascinating one. It's, depending on how you count, it's the second largest economy in the world, very wealthy, very affluent society, yet has great inefficiencies in it. We think of this monolithic export industrial engine, and yet there are great inefficiencies within it. Part of the country is on 60 cycle electric. Part of the country is on 50 cycle electric. They are not interchangeable. So if you are selling, you know, one part of the country, you're going to burn your electric motors in another part of the country. Okay. In my business with International Paper Company, we had advanced packaging machines, and a combination of U.S. technology and Italian technology, machine skills, packaging skills is world class. And so we, International Paper, my company, and a company called Poligrafico Buitoni in Perugia had a packaging machine in Japan, and initially had to inspect for a certain part of Japan that took 50 cycle engine, 50 cycle electricity. The Japanese then decided to install another part of Japan, and the packaging machine just went 10% faster. And it was freakish. It wasn't supposed to go that fast, and ultimately it failed. So that's very, I mean, on its face, that, you know, for inefficient industrial, they can't even get common electricity across their grid. Also, in the telephone systems, there are three major telephone companies. They don't talk to each other. And so if you go to public telephone, there'll be a red one, a green one, and a blue one. And you get to choose which one to use. They're all fine, but you know, that's as efficient as Sony is, as efficient as Panasonic is, there are these pieces that just don't work. So getting back to globalization, I'll try and keep coming back to that. A product's country of origin is increasingly less important than it being a local. So it's sort of old school to say, well, I want to buy, you know, I'm only going to buy American, or I'm only going to buy, you know, Indonesian, or I'm only going to buy, you know, a Swiss watch. It's global where things are produced. And oftentimes a non-local brand will actually be preferred over a domestic brand because it will have a cachet of a global quality and a global image. Just think of like, and interestingly, as xenophobic as the Japanese society is, they have a fascination, not with us as individuals, but with us as a society. And particularly with American music and culture, which I found really interesting. And you look at the most profitable Disney property on the planet is Disney Tokyo. Okay. Now, what does Mickey Mouse have anything to do with Japan? Okay. Is it samurai? No. Is it Kyoto temples? No. It's this fascination with kind of cute. Japanese love cute. I don't know if that's good English, but the Japanese love cute. And that is a runaway success. They also like Western-sounding labels in Japan, even though they may not understand actual translation. It's a foreign-sounding, Western-sounding label. And before we get to Tropicana, we can talk about a really remarkable marketing success in Japan was Coca-Cola's company. They launched a drinking they drink it both hot and cold coffee, and it's RTD coffee, and it's ready to drink coffee, and it is sold in vending machines. Vending machines are ubiquitous in Japan. There are millions of vending machines. It's how anything you can imagine to be sold, to be vended, is, except for like cars or TVs, is you can get it in a vending machine. And Coca-Cola has over a million vending machines. Think of, you know, that's a million is a big number. And to operate, fill, and maintain a million vending machines is a big deal. Okay. I know the team that put this together, they came out with a brand of this ready-to-drink coffee called Georgia. as in the state, okay? And is the state of Georgia particularly known for coffee plantations? No. But it is an interesting and American-sounding word. So it doesn't matter what it means. It's just a cool-sounding word. And in a marketing masterstroke, it's just stunning. I'm a marketing fool, so this is cool stuff for me. But Coca-Cola managers arranged for the who sang Georgia on My Mind? Ray Charles, the late great Ray Charles, traveled as the spokesperson for Georgia coffee to Japan, and he sang his classic Georgia on My Mind, which there's this fascination with American culture, there's a fascination with American music, there's a fascination with American ethnicity. Japanese will not want to talk to a black American, but they're fascinated with black jazz. Okay. So you have Ray Charles, the great Ray Charles, singing Georgia on My Mind. Okay. And this was so successful that this one product, and Coca-Cola has hundreds and hundreds of products around the world, this one single product made up 10% of Coca-Cola Global's profits. Those folks in Atlanta were going, where is all this yink, where's all this coming from? And it was coming from this one product. And so they commit several lines within their vending machines to the Georgia brand. Brilliant. And brilliant because of understanding of the Japanese psyche and connecting a product to a song, to a genre, to a piece of Americana. Brilliant. And successful marketing in Japan is often tied to products that are perceived to be in vogue, and a great number of Japanese consumers connect themselves to the cachet of foreign products. It's interesting. I mean, the national beverage in Japan is not coffee, right? It's tea. But it has a foreign-sounding name with Georgia. It has cool foreign music. And it's just been so successful. Okay, so that's our preface. Let's move to Tropicana, okay? Japanese, traditionally, they don't drink orange juice. Why, are there orange? Yeah, there's some orange groves in Japan, but it's not, you don't have oranges there. So in your own mind, let's say you were given the task of saying, next year I want you to launch, be responsible for the launch of Tropicana Pure Premium in Japan, okay? See you next year. Okay, could you guys do it? How would you do it?
Florida.
Go to Florida? Florida might be able to have some idea. Would you put together a brochure? Try and, how would you do it? And so let's see how Tropicana did it. And Tropicana going back, Tropicana Pure Premium now in the U.S. accounts for 2/3 of the not from concentrate juice, very high quality stuff. And in addition to its dominant domestic position versus Minute Maid, and by the way, Tropicana runs circles around Minute Maid, marketing-wise. That's a whole other story. But it had its first not-for-concentrate export to France. Its first international export was in 1966. But it was not until 1991, actually quite recently, they found a way to enter Japan. And it is, as I mentioned, one of the world's largest and most affluent economies, and one of the most difficult to access. And one of the numerous market hurdles is that Japan, unlike North America and Europe, packaged juice is required to carry a 14-day date code, okay, for shelf life. So if it goes on the shelf, the date code is actually from production date, but they get it to the shelf pretty quickly, you got 2 weeks. Okay, that's going back to irrationality of Japan, that's not necessary. Okay. And the reason this rule was based upon the historic practices for date coating milk that were actually put in by the United States, the occupying forces, that 2-week, 14 days was date coating for milk. But actually, milk is a little bit different from juice, and juice has a substantially lower pH. The pathogens just don't survive. You can get yeast and molds, you know, gas formers in juice, but you're not going to die from sort of funky juice. You can die from funky milk. It can carry pathogens. Juice cannot kill you. And actually with fresh quality control, well-pasteurized juice, everyone know what pasteurized means? What is pasteurization? Heat treatment. Okay. So you heat it up for a short period of time and then you cool it down. That temperature profile puts the yeast and molds to sleep. Doesn't totally kill them, but it puts them to sleep for about 2 months. Okay. And we all heard of Louis Pasteur, right? That's where pasteurization comes from. So in reality, the shelf month in the U.S., you know, we date code over 63 days. And even past that date code is fine. It was very difficult to operate because if you're going to do not from concentrate, okay, you got date, you got to process and package in the United States, and date code to tonk, and then you got to, it's not economical to fly it, so you got to be on the water for a couple weeks to get it to Okinawa or Yokohama. So it just wasn't tenable, and to get it to the market, it was a joint venture that helped them get there. But to do it, you have to bring bulk chilled juice. It had to be imported as bulk juice into Japan. Then it would have to be processed, packaged, date code, and then distributed. So you had to do it in country. Then you'd have to figure out in country distribution. Is that easy? No, it's not. It's profoundly difficult. You'd also have to have ongoing quality control, known as QC, and that would need to be assured on both sides of the Pacific, both on the shipment from the U.S. and inbound in Japan. And then finally, and importantly, you'd need to have a culturally sensitive marketing manager and brand manager to establish the brand in country. So it would be quite a challenge. A frequent approach by global companies that are trying to enter the Japanese market is to collaborate with an established local firm. In fact, trying to set up an independent operation in Japan is culturally problematic and would require years to achieve, if at all. And so you see American companies, whether it be Motorola or Walmart, saying, we know what we're doing, we know how to operate in Arkansas, we can operate in Japan. Okay, they tried to do it around the world, crash and burn. I love it. I don't like Walmart anyway. I can do three-part harmony why I really don't like Walmart. But I love it when they go overseas and they're arrogant and they crash. Okay, product distribution in Japan is, I like the word arcane. It's so complicated, it's Byzantine. You cannot figure it out. You cannot. Don't try. Okay, it's a multi-tiered process and based upon company relationships that go back decades and personal relationships that go back decades. And you think you're going to get off a 747 in Narita and say, hi, I've got a really good product. Who are you going to talk to? Stores are not going to talk to you. You're not an approved vendor because we have an approved vendor list. Okay, and our approved vendor list is closed. Okay. So, how are you going to do it? From a real-world perspective, firms entering Japan that know what they're doing, I tell them, you know, don't delude yourselves. You know what you do well, do that well. Don't try and impose what works in another country in Japan. You will fail. Going back to some of the history before this, in 1988, which was 10 years before its acquisition by PepsiCo, Tropicana's, you know, part of Pepsi portfolio. Tropicana was part of Seagram's, which at the time was the largest distiller and alcoholic beverage company in the world. It's huge. And Seagram had a joint venture with the Japanese brewer Kirin. Anybody drink Kirin beer? It's good stuff. It's good stuff. Huge beverage company. They do the full spectrum of beverages, but they operate well in Japan. And that's a premium, that combination. They had a joint venture, and we call that a, it's not very sophisticated, but we just call that a JV. Okay. So if I ramble and start talking about a JV, that means a joint venture. And a joint venture is a venture where two companies or divisions come together of different companies and form a third company. Okay. It's not, you know, it's not a little part of another company. It's a discrete, independent company formed legally as a third entity. So they were operating, Seagram's was operating already with Kirin, and the management of both companies thought that this JV relationship between Kirin and Seagram could be leveraged to introduce a premium juice brand, Tropicana, in Japan. Again, premium and high-end stuff is very much in vogue in Japan. Tropicana is a world-class brand. Let's see if we can bring it to Japan. So to proceed and manage the market access issues, which are large, a new JV was formed between this division of Seagram, which was Tropicana, and Kirin Beverage Corporation, which was a division of Kirin Conglomerate. And something like 80% of business in Japan is controlled by eight companies, and they're called Kairetsu. And there are these conglomerates. There's interlocking conglomerates. You've probably heard of it. Kirin is a small one of them, but you have huge things like Mitsubishi, huge companies like Fuji. And we say, well, what's Fuji? Well, Fuji makes everything, right? They make the high-end copiers. Fuji is Subaru, right? I didn't know that was a big honking conglomerate. I thought it was some cute little company that made nice cars for people that like L.L. Bean and run around in the woods, you know. Huge conglomerate. So a JV should be synergistic, fancy word that businesses use too much, but synergy is when 2 + 2 = 5. Okay. And so you combine the capabilities of the various partners, capabilities that are complementary, that neither can provide separately. And so what did Tropicana have? Tropicana had a globally recognized product. It had excellent brand management. Americans are really, I'll be arrogant here, Americans are really good at brand management. I mean, bring it on. We are really good at brand management. And we're good at marketing know-how, Tropicana is and was, and process and quality control expertise. We're very good with food. And so that's what Tropicana was bringing to the table. Kirin had capable in-country staff. It had proven distribution channels. Okay. It was an approved vendor to the trade. Okay. So it had these long-standing trade and operational contacts throughout Japan. Okay. So the logic was that the collective abilities of these two partners to the JV could build a formidable market presence in the premium juice market. Right? And so let's see if it's going to work. So the JV is going to be a 50-50 partnership. And 50-50 partnership is actually very difficult to run. Why would it be difficult to run a 50-50 partnership?
Nobody's eyes.
It's high. Okay. Nobody's driving the bus. You have to get on with your partner. Sometimes this company says, well, we want to, you know, our parent company is having a bad year. We need to boost, you know, our stock price or our dividend. And we need to take money out of the business instead of reinvesting it. And the other company said, we want to reinvest in, you know, so it can be very difficult. Personalities can conflict. So it's a real challenge. You need fine management to do it. So in this 50-50 partnership, all marketing, advertising, and operation costs were shared equally, and then the profits were shared by a very complex transfer pricing mechanism. I'm not going to get into that, but complex. And So this chilled bulk juice is today imported by the logistics arm of Kirin Beverage. Okay. And then they are delivered to dairy and beverage plants across Japan for processing and packaging. And all these plants across Japan are called contract packers. And these are often, they are processors that have their own brands, their own product lines, but have excess capacity. So they can add, it's a wonderful thing for them, add a second or third shift doing something for something else, because they can amortize their heavy investment in physical plant at that time. So, and Kieran had the contacts with these contract packers across Japan to process and manage the packaging of this juice. Contract packers are paid for that service. They do not take title to the product. We have a similar situation in the United States with Sam Adams. You know, you see on TV Sam Adams, and you those Mutt and Jeff in front of those nice copper tanks. That's a toy. That's a PR toy, okay? Sam Adams actually brews with contract brewers in existing breweries that they don't own. So if you know the Pittsburgh Brewing Company, maker of the fine brew Iron City beer, god-awful beer, that's where Sam Adams is made. Okay, so Sam Adams is actually a marketing fiction. Sam Adams, you know, Bill Koch, the boss, is actually, he's a certified brewer, but, you know, what they show on TV is Mutt and Jeff, you know, the guys with the beers and the copper kettles back there. That's a toy. You can go visit the toy and staff, you need to. Those are right. So what would Tropicana do? Tropicana would assure the quality control of the citrus juices and related byproducts, such as pulp. And they would share their proprietary process technology for pure premium to maintain the quality. And it's interesting to note that juice can be processed in the same cartons, type of cartons, formed, filled, and sealed on the same stainless steel equipment as milk. So any dairy in the United States, any of your local dairies, they're selling both milk and juice. They can do it on the same equipment. So it's a very easy transition switch for contract packers and dairy companies to do. Okay. And so think about it, the joint venture, the JV, really benefited from a sort of in-place capacity, really swing capacity of the dairies already in country. They did, and this was a big deal. So the juice from the JV's market launch was processed under contract. The first one was the Kaiwai Dairy Company, which is partially owned by Kirin. Okay, if you had been competing with Kirin and Kirin didn't want you to do this, it wouldn't happen. Okay, so not only, you know, all these pieces, if you're not on the side of the good guys, you're not gonna get to market. Okay. And additionally, Tropicana and the JV avoided the need to make a major capital investment, right, in all this processing and packaging equipment. And they didn't have to set up a greenfield operation, which means you build a factory from the ground up. They didn't have to deal with local approvals, which, as you know, if you're in business in the United States, local zoning approvals frequently kill businesses. You say, I've got a great business, I want to build a factory, I want to hire 200 people, that sucker can get stuck in zoning for a year, year and a half, while you're hemorrhaging cash. Okay. Same thing in Japan. Okay. Didn't have to hire new labor, didn't have to train new labor. So with really no operational delays, Tropicana Pure Premium was able to get to market quickly right after the JV was established. And right after contract packing, the retail juice was sold at an agreed upon transfer price from the JV to Kirin Beverage, okay? And the JV had one customer, which was Kirin Beverage. And then Kirin Beverage on-sells into the distribution system in Japan. The JV is not an approved vendor to the trade. Kirin Beverage is an approved vendor through the trade. So the JV has one customer. This takes a lot of faith and trust and really intentional working on a true joint venture, on a true JV. Okay, so Kirin Beverage, the JV would sell to Kirin Beverage. Kirin Beverage would add their markup into the trade, and it would get to market. The distribution system in Japan is incredibly inefficient. We do a lot of things well in the United States. We do distribution really well. And there are six or seven layers of distribution in Japan. So from Kirin Beverage, they would sell to a large wholesaler who would sell to a distributor, who would sell to an order amalgamator, who would sell to a local distributor, who would sell to a retail warehouse, who would then get to the store. Okay, so each of these steps, everybody's not doing it for free, so they're adding their little margin to it. So at the end of the day, the pricing of the juice gets pretty high. But for those of you that have been in Japan, the price of everything in Japan is very, very high. It's also incredibly inefficient because the date coding remains at 14 days. Okay, so instead of making a delivery every other week or every third week to the trade or to a store, you had to make smaller shipments, okay, more frequently to the same stores. Okay, you lose economies of scale. We did that Monday. Okay, so you have to have less on the truck, and you have to run the trucks more, so you're burning more diesel and you're all the time. Okay, and also your production lines, you get economies of scale when you have long production lines. You're not up and down changing, up and down changing. If you could run juice for 3 days, you'd run efficient as hell. Okay, but if you can only run for 45 minutes, okay, it takes you 45 minutes to set up for that run. Okay, whereas opposed to if you set up once 45 minutes, you could run for 3 days. Incredibly, so a very inefficient distribution in Japan. Okay, so we're at a so after this contract packing, we're going to the trade. And also, Monday we talked about first mover advantage. This is actually comes from our economic brethren. They talk about first mover advantage of companies that would make a heavy investment in an industry to get scale, and ultimately then be very competitive, if not prohibitively competitive, against people that are trying to compete with them. But also marketing managers value speed to market and the prospect of such a key competitive benefit of economies of scale economies, and that should always be pursued. And again, we talked about this Monday about China. So Tropicana and Kirin, this JV, they did have first mover advantage. There was nothing competing with them of that high-end juice quality in Japan. This is a good place to be if you're a business. So you're able to establish a market presence that enables the cost advantage of scale, and then the follow-on competitors were faced with extended periods of when you have scale, when you've got volume in a market, and you've got a big piece of that market, it makes it that much more difficult for a competitor to come in because a competitor has no scale, has no sales, right? And so it's going to take months, if not years, for your competitor to get up to volume so they're profitable because you're there first and you've got the market first. Okay. And Tropicana is just beating, it's just beating everybody to market. Okay. Okay, so up to this point, Tropicana had addressed three of the four critical issues for success in Japan. Right, we had the joint venture. We're importing by the boatload. You can actually refrigerate and chill a boat. The United States imports juice concentrate frozen. It's not truly frozen because you can pump it, but we'll call it frozen from Brazil by the boatload, like a 2-inch hose. Okay. And same thing going to Japan. So we figured out we're going to get bulk chilled juice exported to Japan. We figured out we're going to get it processed. We still have to decode it 21 days. Okay, then we have to say, okay, how are we going to distribute it? Okay, Kirin Beverage already has good distribution. We're going to go through that that avenue. And we've got ongoing quality control because QC is incredibly important and health effects are so important in Japan. And in fact, one of the benefits in introducing juice was they talk much more about potassium and folic acid and the vitamin C than we do here in the United States. So we had three of the four things. We were able to import in bulk, we have in-country distribution, we have in-country packaging, we have good QC all the way around. What we didn't have yet was the management team to do that, and the brand management team, because Tropicana is a global brand, and some of the best jobs in business are actually if you're a brand manager. It's incredible, just think if you're the brand manager of Procter & Gamble for Tide, okay? How much is that name Tide worth? How much is that brand worth? How much is the brand Coca-Cola worth? Okay, if you screw up and abuse that brand is worth tens of billions. Okay, and it's a common statement that every bottling plant of Coca-Cola could burn down tonight, and tomorrow every financial institution, every bank in the world would lend Coca-Cola in Atlanta as much money as they needed to rebuild, just because on the strength of the brand, not on the strength of the product. Nothing. There's actually nothing special about the product. It's the cachet and the brand and the feeling of that brand. So up to this point, we've got three of the four pieces taken care of to success. And while going to market in Japan with a major player like Kirin was foundational, ultimate success would depend upon the competence of the JV's senior management. And this is really a central point and an underlying theme in operating globally is you can't be, sounds bad, but you can't be a finance person. I'm arrogant, I've got a marketing perspective on this. But you really have to be culturally sensitive. You have to understand the history, the geography. And some of the best little managers that I know are more sociologists than they are business types. So we have this JV that is going to present a major management challenge. Okay, we're looking at combining a xenophobic management team in Japan with American management. Okay, Americans, most Americans are clueless. Okay, innocence abroad. Okay, I'm embarrassed by Americans overseas sometimes. Not always, but when Walmart decided to go to Brazil, or Walmart went to China, I saw an interview with Walmart's country manager, and the country manager was really good in Arkansas. And it's I laugh but I cry, because so many other countries are way better at producing global managers, international managers than we are. And this idiot they sent to China, he's lost. And this is our best and brightest that we can send overseas. The guy didn't even try to speak Mandarin, and would walk around patting people on the back, which is culturally offensive. I mean, I was embarrassed. Anyway. So here we have a major management challenge, ever more so in Japan, where you really have to understand the history and to navigate a complex, and I would say opaque, business culture. It's a very formal culture, and people's identity are wrapped up in their company. Okay. Here we're much looser. I can quit, I can get fired, I fall down, I get up again, right? I'm all right. In Japan, there's a whole part, well, it's not a large part, but there's part of Tokyo where failed managers go to be homeless. You get, that's true? Okay, and they're shunned by all their coworkers, and they're shunned by their families, and that's where they live. Okay, so they're, here we are, you're going to be dealing with foreigners, these crazy Americans. Actually, they like Americans, but, I mean, we're a little nuts. Okay. And we're going to, we need to succeed because there is no option socially in our society to succeed. In America, we, if somebody runs a business, they're an entrepreneur, it runs for a while, fails, they get back up, they start another business, we say, way to go. Way to go. Some of our best entrepreneurs in America are those that have had a couple business failures and then latch on to stuff. Never happened. I mean, it's too boring to say, but never happened in Japan. So here you've got Japanese, they're going to have to work hard and commit to a joint effort with Gaijin, who are just oozing with Meiwa. How are we going to do this? And it's built upon relationships that go back decades. Okay, so we're going to have a management team from the United States that's not going to go back decades. That's that, at least that's what they thought. Okay. So the JV would need not only a bilingual manager, but one that could understand both the Japanese and American worldviews, and they are quite different. And this manager would also need to act as a bridge between two diverse corporate cultures. Would need to keep all sides focused and collaborating in the right direction. Even though they might not agree on everything, there'd be tons of hand-holding because you've got two corporate cultures. Right? And you look at our friends Daimler-Benz, right? Did a quote-unquote venture with Chrysler. Okay, did that work? No, it didn't work, right? And it was as much a cultural failure of the Germans not understanding the Americans and the Americans taking offense and not understanding who they perceived as arrogant Germans. Germans aren't arrogant, they just seem that way. Okay? And the Germans would talk about their technology, and the Americans would say, well, we got pretty good technology over here, too. And the Germans would kind of say, yeah. Anyway, so if two Western companies can't work it out, right, the difference between European and U.S. isn't that huge, is it? Well, it shouldn't be, but obviously it is sometimes it is. How far difficult is it going to be when we've got Americans who are easygoing, entrepreneurial, have no legacy, you know, that goes back generations and generations and generations. How does not measure themselves, their self-worth by their company. Okay. My eldest son works at headquarters at Panasonic in Secaucus, New Jersey. And it's a very cool company. He's in the tough books. These laptops, very, very expensive, but they're used by EMTs and the police and the military and utilities. These things don't fail. You know, you can actually shoot them, you can throw them 20 feet, you can open up that PC and it works. Okay, can't do that with a Dell. But it's interesting culturally in the U.S. It's a laid-back environment, okay, except when the Japanese come visit, and the American management is smart enough to honor the Panasonic parent. It used to be called Matsushita, but it's now Panasonic is the corporate name. And so on those days, everyone will wear a suit, and everyone will wear the little company pin. And that company pin, it seems like, so what? Right, to us, so what? That's one's identity in Japan. If you have a company pin, you are somebody. You are somebody in that society. You are connected with Sony. You are connected with Panasonic. You are connected with, you know, Mitsubishi. You are somebody. And so you have to wear your pin. Anyway, so this culturally sensitive companies can bridge it. Culturally insensitive companies don't even recognize there's a bridge to cross. So had to find a person, keep exercise focus, need to be collaboration in the right direction, and be responsible, all that kind of cultural stuff, that social stuff, responsible at the end of the day for quality brand management, product development, and consumer education, okay? How big a pool of people are you going to find? It's not going to be that big a pool. And that's why global managers are really, really well paid, because there's not that many of them. Supply and demand. And to do business really well in Japan, you've got to speak. Do you have to speak Japan? Yes. Japanese? Yes. You've got to speak Japanese. Except there's an old-fashioned traditional Japanese that you also, in some meetings, some formal meetings, the conversation will digress to old formal Japanese. It's sort of like Chaucer. Anybody read Chaucer in original? I can't. You know? And it's not just these and thous. It's a whole other. So you need to be able to, you know, when the conversation goes over here, you got to go with it. And the senior managers in Japan, you know, who don't necessarily speak English, that's where they're going to go. Where they're going to have a deep conversation. You know, kind of like in Narnia, right? Talk about the deep magic. Mm-hmm. When you're having these deep conversations, they move into this old traditional Japanese. This kind of stuff, and I can't do it. But I've been in these meetings, and if I knew Japanese, I'd still be lost. Okay. So there was a professional search. I'm really making a point here that central to operating globally, you have to have global management. And we in America, we don't produce anywhere near enough. But so they did find a highly capable manager. He was identified and hired, and it's really interesting that this JV director was not only bilingual. I know him personally, bilingual and bicultural. Okay, married a Japanese woman. Okay, also a U.S. citizen. Okay, and is a fourth generation of his family to reside in Japan. Okay, his great grandfather came to Japan as a language teacher from Harvard in the late 19th century. What's the pool of management that you're going to find that could succeed? That's why Japan is so hard to deal with. And this is Paul Guilfoyle. Guilfoyle is actually an Irish name. During the Meiji Restoration, when in Japan, 1860s, when Japan decided to become a modern country. Remember the movie with Tom Cruise? What was the name of that movie?
The Last Samurai.
The Last Samurai. Okay. A great story, totally stupid, untrue, nonsense. Okay. The Meiji and the society decided, you know, we are going to become a modern, advanced economy. We're not going to be put upon and patronized to by the Western European powers. And they did it in a generation. Okay. And Guilfoyle's great-great-grandfather was part of that, from Harvard, came to teach English, the global language. anyway, that's the caliber of person to work with. So now we have the key commercial factors in place. We have the first cartons of Tropicana for coffee trade, entered the market under the Kirin Tropicana label in 1991. Next year, they did the full-blown pure premium. Very interesting, on the packaging, they get the full benefit of the Tropicana image. They get the full benefit of Tropicana name. But at the bottom, in both Japanese, and by the way, the facings are all English because that's global branding. You know, if it were in Japanese, it wouldn't have the cachet. So this is a high-quality global product that the Japanese will like. But at the bottom, on the labeling, they will say quality assured by Kirin Beverage. Because we're not going to trust all those guys eating that far. Okay. So here they are rolling out, and it was a success. And so you had a brand, high-quality brand, very well-marketed, well-positioned, and with an American cachet. And this American cachet is reinforced from time to time with iconic American music. Okay, so the management knows exactly what they're doing. They're connecting this sort of fascination with American culture to the Tropicana. And last time I was there, they were advertising with this there's this band Mungo Jerry, okay, and I'm gonna try it. But it's, you know, in the summertime when the weather is fine, you can look right up and touch the sky in the sun. Da 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 da. Right. Right? And magic. I mean, in Japan, that it's cool here. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievably cool there. Okay. And is that rational? No. But that's marketing. And so it's a leading share, continues to hold a leading share in really one of the world's most competitive and quality conscious markets. Final point I want to get to is that they're managing this well, and Minute Maid, which is has a JV with Meiji, a large dairy company in Japan, is not doing well. And it all comes down to management. Because Tropicana is priced and promoted and positioned as a very high-end product, and so people will pay a premium for it. Minute Maid, they have a churning of management. Well, we'll sell Billy, or we'll sell Betty Sue from Atlanta. We'll send her to Tokyo. You have some foreign experience. Okay. So Betty Sue or Bobby will go over there, and they'll say, "Well, I need to do something different, make my mark." So they'll change the marketing program. They'll change the market position. So they'll say, "Well, I think we'll do real better if we drop our pricing." So here you are charging, you know, a buck and a half for 8 ounces of juice, and the next day you charge a buck. Okay. Now we're going to see sales rise, right? Wrong. Not in Japan. You just gutted yourself. You totally destroyed a position that had been developed over years. Okay. And now you're just telling the trade that you were ripping them off and gouging them for all these years. Okay. And interestingly, the people in the trade would come back to Paul Guilfoyle, the director of the Kirin Tropicana JV, and they said, "What are these people at Minute Maid doing?" Because the people in Japan couldn't figure it out. The people in the business couldn't figure out how stupid these Americans are. Okay. Anyway, Paul Guilfoyle is American citizen, so there are a few very capable folks. Final point here is that, you know, the center of the universe of beverages in Japan is green tea. It's not juice, and it's high in both antioxidants and actually quite high in caffeine. And the carbonated beverage market is flat and declining in Japan just like it is globally. And the interesting challenge that Guilfoyle has, He's not delusional that you know, he's going to change eating habits in Japan. Because at breakfast, I mean, you know, at supper in America, do we drink juice? No, we don't. At breakfast, we drink juice. Why do we do that at breakfast and not dinner?
Marketing.
Or, I mean, it's not rational. I mean, it's still good for you at 8 o'clock at night. It's still good for you at 8 in the morning. But we don't drink it at night.
Acid reflux.
Acid reflux.
True. Doctor said don't drink it at night.
All right. But the typical Japanese breakfast is rice, fish, a little bit of fish, a little dried fish, miso soup, a little pickle, and green tea. Okay. The Mavericks here would be in revolt if you gave them a Japanese breakfast. Just on a marketing, you know, twinkling that, wouldn't it be interesting to see if you could introduce and have, in addition to green tea, you could have orange juice for breakfast in Japan. But it's not a mainline drink, but it is highly successful product for both the Japanese and the U.S. So that's how it's done. And in your own mind's eye, was that how you would do it? Or were those, I mean, probably not. And, you know, the hurdles, the point being that the hurdles to do that or to do business in Japan are huge. And it comes into another issue of balance of trade or fair trade. And it's simplistic for a Japanese company to sell in the United States. It's anything but simplistic for us to export to the second largest economy in the world. Okay. So, if there are any questions on the panel, I'm happy to answer. Yes.
So what time of day do the Japanese drink their orange juice?
They usually in the afternoon, lunch and in the afternoon. And it's a fashion drink, it's a vogue drink. And people want to be seen drinking. It's similar to in the United States. Not that I hang around in bars, but I've been in a few bars in my life. And people that drink Heineken, okay, they drink Heineken in the bottle. Okay, don't drink it on tap. Why? So they can be seen drinking Heineken in the bottle. That's cool, right? Yeah.
What stance is the U.S. government taking with respect to fair trade with Japan?
Really, it's with the wind, with the administration. Some are hands off. Some people trying it. I don't think. Well, I'll be nasty. I don't think there is a coherent trade policy in the United States. Yes.
Corporate governance question. That joint venture, was that the board of directors, was it 50-50 between Karen and...
It was 50-50. Okay. It's kind of amazing.
The CEO above, was above the board of directors?
No, the director of, he is a CEO, but he's called the director, his title of director of the JV. But it's a good question, and they have governance is on the board of directors of the JV is true 50-50. Which is a gut check. I mean, if you didn't have to do it, I wouldn't want to do it. But to get going, you do it. Yes.
I work for a large normal aerospace company. I do a lot of work with Japanese people, and one of the things that I see that I haven't seen come out here tonight, but to do business with Japanese people, because of the need for the long cultural connections, you think about this. If you're going to go out and buy something here in the United States, you're going to go to the store and you're going to talk to someone who you've never spoken to before. They're going to tell you, this is the best product, spend your money here. You're going to lay your money down and pick up that product and take it home. In Japan, you go to someone that you've known for a long time. And if they steer you wrong, they've lost business for a lifetime. They're not going to do that. And so, doing business with someone that you know very well, someone that your grandfather or great-grandfather did business with, you know that what they say is going to be correct. You know you're not going to get taken. And so from a business standpoint, their model actually works very well. We scoff at it sometimes here in the United States, but realistically, it's tried and true over thousands of years. It works.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it just because I'm contrarian, I agree with that. But again, that also then limits risk taking.
Yes.
And
what risk?
They
are risk averse for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. So Airbus, for example, can't sell airplanes in Japan because they haven't sold airplanes in Japan. That's the reason. They've been trying for ever since they've been a company.
One further comment just on corporate etiquette protocol is that I tell my students this: when you have a business card, okay, business card has someone's name on it, has the company logo on it. Japanese gives that to you. That's who they are, okay, and they'll give it to you carefully with two. You know, with two hands, okay, and you should take it from them with two hands, okay, and you should look at it and you should study it, and you should, even though you don't understand a damn thing, look at it, and then you should treat the business card with respect, you know, and don't put it in your pocket. That's a sign of disrespect, like it's not important. Now we're going to have our meeting. No, take the business card and put it down very carefully. And you take the, I was in a meeting once with our company, another American company, and a Japanese company, and the American gave out credit cards across, shot them across the conference table. Okay, he got them back. He kind of stacked them, put them there from the Japanese. I'm like, you know, sometimes telepathically, you're just saying, just sit there, don't do anything. You know, just shut the hell up. Just don't do anything, because whatever you're doing now is mea culpa, and just shut up. But it kept going. And then he needed to write something down, and he took one of their business cards and started writing on it. And so that was, I totally wasted like 3 days. I took days to set this thing up, and I got an idiot gotten off a plane. And so this cultural things that, you know, the guy wasn't stupid at all. He was just ignorant. And
I also find when they hand you a business card, if you look at the card and ask them a question, they really like that, question about anything on the card.
Yeah. But that their identity is wrapped up in that card. Yeah.
In the Tropicana case, did Tropicana approach someone in Japan, or did Japan approach the Tropicana company because they wanted that juice?
It was a meeting between Seagram's and Kirin, and they had developed a long-term relationship. And it was just marketers will sit around and say, well, okay, we've got this market, we've got this market share, what else can we bring to market? And so this premium, they said, well, you know, Seagram had this other brand portfolio, and it just came out of conversation. So it wasn't the U.S. Everybody was happy that this was going to work, but it was an evolution that came out of that Seagram strategy. So, yes.
Fashion in the United States doesn't last very long. How do you maintain that in Japan?
That's an excellent question.
It's a fashion.
That's an excellent question. That's actually an excellent question. So part of the business planning each year is to introduce new flavors and new packaging formats and new sizes to kind of keep the interest. And the mainline product, Tropicana Pure Premium, is sort of carries through like an old battleship, but they're continually introducing, you know, peach flavor this and kiwi flavor that in different packages to maintain the vogue. And that's actually a huge huge point. It's also Gatorade, which is also another division of Pepsi, basically failed in Japan because they just relied on one package and one product and one format. And, you know, Pepsi's a big company. They're really good at what they do, but not always. And so these two divisions, there's a Gatorade division, had a joint venture with Snowbrand, which is a dairy in Japan, and they didn't talk to the successful Tropicana folk on how to handle product in Japan. It's a very good question, and Gatorade failed because they did not refresh the brand and keep things in vogue. All right, I think we've bang on time, so thank you.
Thank you.